I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is growing pressure on the Bush administration to explain just how it used intelligence information to justify its attack on Iraq. Whether the threat of chemical and biological weapons was really as imminent as the president warned. The intelligence committees of both the House and the Senate will be considering how they want to handle these questions. A rather angry and accusatory preview of these encounters comes from Britain, where Prime Minister Tony Blair has been put under tremendous pressure by opposition politicians and MPs within his own party. His former Secretary of State for International Development, Clare Short, accuses Blair of cooking up a secret pact of aggression with President Bush, a deal to go to war made even before questions about Iraqi weapons were placed before the United Nations. Aside from whatever the President or the Prime Minister may have agreed to, this renewed scrutiny on the relationship between these two leaders refocuses attention on the historical special relationship between Britain and the United States. Connection listeners, these two nations were the very core of this coalition. So what happens to their standing if the world determines that their information was shoddy or deceptive? Furthermore, the two leaders isolated themselves from traditional allies in the push for war in Iraq, so what happens next? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And our guest this hour is the Labour MP from Birmingham, Britain's former Secretary of State for International Development, Clare Short. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
It's good of you to be here. I want to start today, if I can, with what you told the Foreign Affairs Select Committee yesterday. In fact, we have a short clip of that. Let's listen to it together.
The Prime Minister must have concluded that it was honourable and desirable to back the US in going for military action in Iraq, and that it was therefore honourable for him to persuade us, through the various ruses and devices he used, to get us there. I presume that he saw it as honourable deception.
That's the voice of the Labour MP, Clare Short, speaking yesterday before a parliamentary inquiry in Britain. And Ms. Short, the words that you use there are careful. You talk about ruse and devices and honourable deception. Is it a parliamentary way of accusing the Prime Minister of just lying?
In a way, yes. And I think there were a series of untruths, exaggerations. I mean, the first being, yes, of course, the Saddam Hussein regime was committed to having laboratories and scientists working on developing chemical and biological weapons. But that was presented as though it was weaponized, imminently usable, and the suggestion was made that there were potential links with Al-Qaeda and this stuff would get into the hands of terrorists. Now, there was no link whatsoever of any kind with Al-Qaeda, and it wasn't as weaponized as that. That's step one. Step two, our Prime Minister promised us repeatedly that there'd be a second resolution, that is, if Dr. Blix would be allowed to complete his inspection process, and if he failed, the matters would come back to the Security Council, and it was through the UN that the decision to then probably authorise military action would be taken. But that didn't happen. And he told us that it couldn't happen because France had said it would veto any second resolution. And then later we found that France hadn't said that. France had said that they would vote against anything if it was brought before Blix had completed his process. But if Blix failed to achieve disarmament, then France would support military action through the Security Council. And so on, if you see what I mean. They were driving to start the conflict by the spring, before the hot of the summer in Iraq. And then there was a series of exaggerations or half-truths or deceptions to keep the British people, who didn't want it except authorised through the UN, to keep us all on board, so that I think Tony Blair could keep the promise he obviously made to President Bush.
Now, you were in the cabinet in the autumn and in the winter months when the security intelligence officials were providing the information for the British government. Based on what you saw and based on what Britain chose to do, are you saying that the Prime Minister took the information and spun it, deliberately misleading the country with his own interpretation?
Well, I am saying it was spun. I did see all both the raw intelligence and then the assessments that are made by our Joint Intelligence Committee right throughout the crisis. you know, some of the ministers involved in foreign affairs see more than other members of the cabinet, and I did see it all. And there's no doubt that our security services were convinced, as I am and as most of the UN weapons inspectors have been, that Saddam Hussein was trying to develop chemical and biological weapons. We know that he tried nuclear, but the previous weapons inspectors had dismantled all that. And we know he had ballistic missiles because Dr. Blix achieved the destruction of 64 ballistic missiles, which was a considerable achievement. So that's what the intelligence was saying, and that once Dr. Blix and his inspectors went in, there was a hiding of that of that material and the evidence of the scientists' work and so on. So I think where the spin came was calling that weapons of mass destruction, and most people in the world hearing that phrase would think of a sort of bomb loaded with chemicals about to drop on people, and would be amazed if that ended up just being some scientists working in a lab. So the intelligence was there that there was a commitment to the scientific work. The exaggeration was to make it seem like an immediate threat, which of course creates a sense of urgency for dealing with it, rather than, given that it had been 12 years, let's do it right. I mean, I'm not one of those who said we should have just gone on with containment. I think Saddam Hussein shouldn't have been allowed to continue to defy the UN. The people of Iraq were suffering terribly as a result of the sanctions, and they needed relief. And indeed, I think Saddam Hussein is a war criminal, and he should have been indicted and brought to the international tribunal. But I think it was our duty, given that there wasn't an imminent threat, to exhaust all other means of bringing justice to the people of Iraq short of war, and only resorting to war if we had no other way, now, in accordance with the teaching on the just war. And that is what I think we didn't do. And so the exaggerations and so on were necessary to create this sense of urgency to get us to war by the spring on the timescale that had been agreed.
All right, let's go beyond the exaggeration to this agreement, because as you'll appreciate with your time in politics, the accusation you're making of a secret deal involving the U.S. President George Bush has some pretty powerful ramifications on this side of the Atlantic. It's also a claim that the president was part of this clandestine arrangement. What's your evidence that there was this deal between Blair and Bush even before it went to the U.N. for a first resolution?
Well, I mean, there are three very senior figures in the Whitehall establishment who told me that the target date was February the 15th, long before.
These are senior intelligence officials when you say Whitehall, is that right?
I don't want to embarrass them, and I'm not going to name them. They're very senior figures in a position to know. And they said the target date was February. And later extended to March, because if you remember, there was difficulties about Turkey not cooperating.
How long ago were you told? February 15th? Was this in the autumn?
Yes, in the autumn of 2002. But at that time, our Prime Minister was telling me, the Cabinet, the Parliamentary Labour Party and the country, that he was committed to a second resolution. So that seemed to me a contradiction. And I preferred at that stage to believe what the Prime Minister was saying, and to believe that we should try and keep the world united and go for the second resolution and try to handle it through the UN for everybody's sake. But since then, if you look at what happened and the way in which they truncated the Blix process, why didn't we give Blix enough time to do his job properly? If you remember, there was lots of material in the press suggesting that it was too hot in the summer months to fight in Iraq, and then that we couldn't leave troops sitting in the desert, so we had to get on with it. But we knew about the heat of the summer when the troops were deployed, and you can rotate troops and bring some home and put some more out there. I mean, we were told in Britain that we were threatening military action and deploying troops in order to try and avoid war if we could. And I believed in that. I believed that's how we got Resolution 1441. But then we were told we had to go to war because the troops had been deployed. And that meant Blix was cut short. That meant the Security Council didn't agree. The majority of members of the Security Council didn't agree to cut Blix short.
Claire Short, I wonder if I can just move quickly ahead to where we are right now, because as this parliamentary inquiry unfolds in Britain, and as the sort of testimony that you and Robin Cook gave yesterday is heard and reported, you know that the intelligence committees in Washington are beginning to take a sober second look at what information was available and how it may have been spun in this country. You're also a student of the relationship between the two countries here. What's at stake here as this sort of forensic examination of the past 8 months is picked apart? What's at stake when we look at the relationship between the United States and Great Britain? We're not just talking about the two leaders, Blair and Bush.
No, indeed not. And I think we're not just talking about the relationship between the two countries. We're talking about the relationship between the US and Europe, and then to some degree the rest of the world, because the UK and the US have ended up being isolated from the opinion of most of the rest of the world. The first thing I would say is, whatever the route we got to war and whatever criticisms people like me have about how we got there, we should all unite in trying to support the people of Iraq in rebuilding their country and making sure that the US doesn't get bogged down there in more and more conflict. And there's very worrying, I think 40 American soldiers have died since the conflict ended. I really think we should work together to improve that. I think we won't have a decent atmosphere in the Middle East unless we really do drive forward the roadmap and establish a safe and secure Palestinian state alongside a safe and secure Israel, and that's not going to be easy. But
the very testimony that you're giving before the parliamentary inquiry is discrediting the reason why the United States and Britain went to war. That's only going to make matters worse. I'm not suggesting, for example, that you sit on it or that you stay in the cabinet and keep your mouth shut, but you'll see that as the justification...
I don't agree with you. I think these matters are so important. I mean, political decisions to go to war are such big decisions, and people's lives are lost and put at risk, that I feel it's my duty to share my analysis and judgment and information with others so that Britain can learn what it needs to learn about how we make our decisions and what was done. But I'm also very clear that the situation in Iraq is dangerous for the people of Iraq, and it's dangerous for the world. It could feed the sense of bitterness and anger and division, recruitment of angry young people in the Middle East, terrorist organisations, and the root bitterness is Israel-Palestine. And those things, I just want to make it clear that I think we should get to the truth, but we should all act together on those. And then more broadly, the UK-US relationship, I think it... This is really to do with the way the United States sees its role in the world. I mean, clearly it's the biggest power, it's the only big power in the world, a hyperpower, as people are calling it. It's economically very wealthy, and it's probably 50%, I believe the estimate is, of all the armed capacity in the world is in the hands of the US. And there's a danger, I think, that the US, hurt and angry as it is after September 11th, is just projecting its power on anyone that gets in its way. And there's a danger that there's more and more kind of hatred and division built up in the world. And this would be bad for the United States, bad for the world. We don't want that hatred and division. We want a world where we share our economic wealth and technology and have a decent future.
I have
for
to
everybody.
Stop you there. We're stepping away for a short break. We'll come back and I'll let you complete that thought. My guest this hour, the Right Honourable Claire Short, we're talking about testimony that she made yesterday accusing the United States and Britain of cooking a deal to lead a war in Iraq even before it went to the United Nations. And Connection listeners, we'd like to have you in at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking this hour with Claire Short, former member of Tony Blair's cabinet. Yesterday, she testified at a House of Commons inquiry that the Prime Minister and George Bush had a secret deal to go to war. And if this accusation ends up being true, what does it signify for both leaders? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Ms. Short, you said that the United States and Britain isolated themselves in this small coalition. And if these accusations that there was a deal, if there's more, comes more to that, are they not then going to be even further isolated?
Well, I mean, I was trying to answer your question about the future of the relationship between Britain and the US. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying you can't isolate it from the relationship of the US to the rest of the world. And I think learning the lessons of Iraq mean both countries keeping our closeness, and the closeness between our people and our language and so on, should determine to be better multilateralists, to work with the rest of the international community, to be committed to justice for poor and oppressed people, as well as to dealing with terrorist organisations that have threatened the US, to strengthen the United Nations and a commitment to the international rule of law, and to work harder at development for the poorest countries. And I'm not just saying this because these are nice, kind things. I'm saying if we don't work in that way, we're going to have more and more danger, bitterness, division, and terrorism.
But you also made the case that Prime Minister Blair was in a position to exercise a little bit of leverage, and he failed to do that. He was the person who was closest to President Bush, that he was the person who might well have persuaded the United States to take a more multilateral approach. And he, what did he do? Did he squander that opportunity? Did he miss it? Did he never intend to take it up?
Well, I think many people, including me in Britain, thought that that's what he was trying to do, that there'd been these very belligerent noises from the Bush administration about dealing with Iraq, and we thought that our Prime Minister was trying to use our historically close relationship with the US to persuade the US administration to go on the UN route, to stick with the rest of the international community, to resolve the crisis in Iraq and the problem of Saddam Hussein and his defiance of the UN. Yes, get on with it, we agreed with that, but to do it multilaterally. And I think that Tony Blair, I mean, the US didn't want to act alone, and it's very clear how they keep referring to coalition, 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 but the coalition is US 250,000 troops, UK 45,000 troops, Australia 2,000. Nobody else. There's a list of 40-odd countries, but a lot of them are just poor countries that, because the US pressed them to say they supported the coalition, they said it. But so it wasn't really a coalition, yet I think the American people would not have wanted America acting alone. So it was important to have Britain, because then it looked like a coalition. And if Tony Blair had said, Britain will support you, but only on these conditions, that we go through the UN, that we exhaust the possibilities before we get to conflict, I think the US, if it wanted a coalition and wanted to persuade the American people that it wasn't alone, might well have gone that way, and we might have dealt more wisely and in a more internationally united way with the situation in Iraq. And indeed, if it had come to military conflict, it would have had more support across the world, and we might have made better preparations for afterwards and not have the chaos we've got in Iraq now. And I think he squandered that. I think Tony Blair failed to make the offer conditional to your president. He just committed the UK to support, and therefore we didn't add any value.
Now, you came very close to resigning in frustration back in the middle of March. You chose to stay in the cabinet during the war itself, and then resigned in early May. Were you then, during that period of time, still expecting that both Britain and the United States would at some point say, fine, now the United Nations will take over? It seems in hindsight to be something of a naive hope.
Well, you're right. I planned to leave the government and said so publicly, and then our Prime Minister persuaded me, made a lot of effort persuading me to stay, and I knew the war was unstoppable by then. The vote in the House of Commons couldn't be lost because the Conservative Party was voting with the government, so it was all just a question of the size of the rebellion. So the US was determined, and the vote was going to carry in the UK. And I had very strong undertakings from my Prime Minister that the reconstruction of Iraq would be multilaterally organised, that the UN would be given its proper role, which is to help bring into being an interim Iraqi government and then, you know, arrangements for a constitution and elections, just as has been done in East Timor, Kosovo, Afghanistan and so on, and that the coalition would adhere to its Geneva Convention obligations that lie on all occupying powers in occupied territory to keep order and keep civil administration going. And then through going to the UN, we'd get international cooperation, we'd get the IMF and the World Bank engaged, and any economic reform would be done transparently. And that would be the best chance of getting Iraq up and going and reconstructed, because it's naturally a wealthy country and it's got lots of educated people. Those undertakings were given to me, but they were breached. And clearly, the coalition hasn't given the UN the role that it should properly play.
And when you look back on that now, I'm wondering if you regret not leaving. There was that quote of one of your senior colleagues saying, Claire could have changed history if she had resigned before the war. That's got to hurt.
Well, I certainly got a lot of flack and attacks for not going then. There was a very, of course, passionate and emotional atmosphere in this country. We'd had the biggest demonstration we've ever had in the history of Britain against the war, uniting enormous range of people. But the truth is, if I'd resigned, the Labour vote against would have been higher, but the vote would still have carried and we still would have gone to war. It isn't true that I had in my hands the power to stop the UK supporting it. If I had, I would have used it. But I personally would have been more popular if I'd gone. In a way, it would have been easier for me to go then, but I think I would have felt that I didn't try at least to contribute to the proper reconstruction of the country. And if I'd seen all the mess there is now and thought maybe I could have made a difference. Anyway, I accepted the word of my Prime Minister and I stayed and I did my best to unite a lot of countries that had been against the war in a willingness to engage in the reconstruction. I had a lot of talks at the World Bank meeting that we all went to recently. And then the undertakings that I'd given to other countries and to the House of Commons about the way in which the UN would be asked to help bring into being an interim Iraqi government were breached, and it was the end of the line for me. I couldn't defend what our government had done, and the promises that were made to me were broken. So it's been a very hard time for me, but in a way I'm glad that I tried everything, and I now don't have any doubt about leaving the government, because I think what we've done is indefensible and I can't defend it, and therefore I couldn't be there.
Connection listeners, my guest this hour is the Right Honourable Claire Short. She resigned in early May from Tony Blair's cabinet. She was Secretary of State for International Development and testified at a parliamentary inquiry yesterday about a secret deal that existed back last autumn between Prime Minister Blair and President Bush to go to war in the winter of 2003. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's get some of you in on our conversation. First to Lafayette, Louisiana, and Fred's on the line. Hi, Fred.
Yes, I'd like to just make a quick comment. I think it's very easy yet unfortunate for this guest, for Ms. Short, to make these accusations. But then when the question is posed by you to say, well, who told you these things? Who told you that there was a planned date, a deadline by which there was an agreement before any resolution before the UN to go to war? And the answer is, well, I don't want to embarrass those people. It doesn't seem like, with all the accusations she's made thus far, that she's very concerned about confidentiality. But if these things are going to be properly investigated, and in fact they're indeed, her accusations are indeed true, my question is, doesn't she think it's important for her to reveal that information so that those things can be properly investigated? And I'll hang up so I can listen to the response.
Thanks for your call, Fred.
Thank you.
Claire.
Should I answer?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I think this is a reasonable point. What I'm saying doesn't rest. I am saying three senior people told me, and I'm not going to reveal their names. There's a book that Number 10 Downing Street, the very senior people collaborated on, an instant Guardian newspaper book. It's one of our big newspapers that has a quote about President Bush and Tony Blair meeting in, I think it was September 9th, and having a conversation as they went for a walk about their commitment to war and how a year before they hadn't thought a war was necessary, but now it's clear that it was. But my third point is, there is no other explanation of refusing to allow Blix to complete his inspection process when he had achieved the destruction of 64 ballistic missiles except that there was a preset date, because that's what divided the world and caused all the bitterness and weakened the coalition. And it's inexplicable, except that they were working to a date. And if you remember, through certainly in the British media, and I assume it was also so in the US, there was all this talk about not being able to fight during the Iraqi summer because it was so hot, and not being able to leave troops in the desert. And therefore, the evidence is coming from all sorts of different sources and from what took place, that they were committed to an early date. And that's why they truncated BLICS, and that's why the international community was divided. And then we were all misled about what the French position was.
I mean, exactly the same sort of debate took place on this side of the ocean with the protracted debate leading up to the one UN resolution that was passed unanimously, 1441, and then the rather dramatic appearance of Secretary of State Colin Powell for the Security Council, where it was reported that he had been persuaded by information given to him by the intelligence community that perhaps the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were so dangerous that a war was necessary. And if, Claire Short, what you're telling us is that all of that was a sham, then I'm wondering whether or not, you know, you're going to be able to, a month from now or whenever, continue to say, I don't want to embarrass those three people. You're sitting on something which in this country could be something of a political fireball, and I'm sure it will have the same effect in Great Britain as well.
Well, but there's other people. I mean, there's this parliamentary inquiry taking place openly before a parliamentary committee. We've got a committee of senior parliamentarians that meets in private to supervise the work of the intelligence services that's also conducting an inquiry. So I'm not the only actor here. There's a lot of academics and journalists at work.
Fair enough, but you're a politician with a reputation for speaking her mind.
Indeed, and I don't resile from that. And I feel it's my duty to put this truth and evidence as I understand it and have crawled over it and thought about it and read into the public domain, because these are such serious matters. But all I'm trying to say is that the findings about when the decisions were made, what the intelligence said, whether it was spun, will rest on the evidence of lots of different players, not just on my evidence. And judgments will be made having taken advice and evidence from a whole range of players. So I'm simply making the point that I have my testimony to give, but there are a lot of other people who will be giving their testimony too.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 to Hatfield, Massachusetts. Now Richard's on the line. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. First of all, I'd just like to commend Ms. Short for speaking up and for her testimony, which I think is great. And I also think this is nothing new, you know, and that it was clear to a lot of us before the war happened that the decision had already been made. But my question has to do with where we go from here and what you think the outcome, or what you would like the outcome of your testimony to be. I mean, I fully support the agenda that you were articulating earlier, but I wondered, you know, specifically about the impact you might think your testimony would have on Prime Minister Blair, or over here on President Bush, who's, you know, will probably face something like the same kind of inquiry. But so far, you know, people are noting that he's changed his line from, you know, weapons of mass destruction to now weapons programs. But, you know, he just defiantly, you know, doesn't back down so far. But I wondered if you think that Blair will, or what will happen.
You've called for his resignation, Claire.
Well, I said in a newspaper interview that I thought it would be good if he planned an elegant handover. Good for our government, good for our party in government. And that's my view, but now it's the judgment of others. There's been a loss of trust in the UK. The trust of the people in our Prime Minister has declined considerably, but that will be played out through the political arena. For our system of government, there are lessons to learn about decision-making procedures, normal sort of committee structures in the Whitehall machine didn't meet. It was all done very personally in the Prime Minister's study and in his telephone calls and meetings with President Bush, and I think we've got to learn lessons of ways in which such mighty decisions as going to war are made and make sure we improve our machinery of government.
You've also talked about a presidential style of leadership that Tony Blair has brought to Downing Street, and I'm wondering whether or not you believe the checks and balances that you're talking about exist already within the parliamentary system to correct that, if that's seen to be something that's not working well for the people of that he represents.
I think that's we've got a problem in our system because, of course, as is a parliamentary system, so when we have an election with a big majority, and Mrs. Thatcher had that, and now our government has it, you've got an automatic, very big majority in the House of Commons, and we've got this tradition of strong party discipline, and that means you've got someone as powerful as a president with an inbuilt automatic majority in the House of Commons, and therefore the check is very weak. And I think we need to look at our system, and it used to rely on a cabinet of equals, of senior figures in the majority party, hammering out and discussing policy and making decisions and then being accountable, all of them, back to their party. Now power has got concentrated in the hands of one individual. I think we need to look at, are we going to go on with the parliamentary system? Should we elect a president and then have a parliament without an automatic majority that then has to be persuaded of the propositions? There are some very big questions for our political system that come out of this. But for the world, more urgently, the question that your the person who telephoned in raised, I think the lessons are about persuading the US not to think it must use its power on its own against the rest of the world. I think that is really dangerous for the US. It makes more and more antagonism across the world to the US. It probably recruits people to terrorism. It's just more bitterness and hurt for everybody. And I think, I mean, your country has such enormous power. It's easy, and it's so angry and hurt, quite understandably, by September the 11th. The danger is that it just uses its power in a bullying way and divides itself from the rest of the world. And I think the lesson for our two countries and our close relationship is to not do that again, to be more patient, for the US to wear its power more wisely and more respectfully of the rest of the world, and for Britain to be a friend that helps that to be achieved, so we can work together for a better and more just world order. I think there's two futures in front of us, and one is quite ugly and dangerous.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you in on my conversation with Clare Short, former British Secretary of State for International Development, in particular on the relations between Britain and America in the months ahead. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. My guest this hour, the Right Honourable Clare Short, Labour MP from Birmingham Ladywood, former Secretary of State for International Development. You will know her name most recently from news yesterday in which she said to a parliamentary inquiry in Britain that there was a secret deal between the United States and Great Britain dating back to early September of last year, a deal to go to war in the winter of 2000.
Spring of 2003, yeah.
2003. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's just go straight back to our telephone lines. Juan's on the line calling in from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hi, Juan.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Yes, my question is that, madam, how do you think that the United Nations would have been able to help the situation, considering that both France and Germany were in the process of blocking our attempts to be able to have a coalition, and that you see France and Germany both had a vested interest in Iraq, considering that France had the contracts with Saddam Hussein to be able to go into the oil fields and produce oil since Saddam Hussein had locked out the American companies? The United States
Let's stick with what you were saying at the very beginning, Juan, in terms of what the UN might have been able to achieve that the coalition was proposing. I don't want to go too far into into contracts.
Yes, what you just said about France and oil isn't accurate. They might have had some contracts, but they didn't control the whole of the oil. In fact, it was nationalised, and Iraqi engineers worked on it, and it was all subject to UN sanctions. So,
but
let's,
beyond that,
let's park that. No,
if we left this at the UN, I think there's a sense that people would be talking about it still and taking away everything about the weapons of mass destruction.
I want to answer that question. It had been 12 years, I mean, that is right, since the first Gulf War, and when the Iraq had been subject to sanctions and required to disarm. And I agree with all those who say something had to be done about it, both because Saddam Hussein shouldn't defy the UN and also, more importantly, because the people of Iraq were really suffering very badly because of the sanctions. The threat to consider the possibility of military action led to unanimous agreement to Resolution 1441, unanimous, including Syria, and everyone agreeing that weapons inspectors had to go back in, that Saddam Hussein had to cooperate this time, or the world would act together. That was a big achievement, and that was very important. And Dr. Blix went back in, got in by November, had to bring all his inspectors in. They have to be very professional and expert people and have their equipment. Started to work, got the first dossier, if you remember, from Saddam Hussein denying everything. That's the kind of man he was. But then Blix went on. He achieved the destruction of the ballistic missiles. He came back to the Security Council and made a number of reports about his progress. And he made it clear he needed some more time. I think he talked a month or so to see whether his process of making sure that all the old reports that previous inspectors had left about where there were materials unaccounted for, whether all of that could be dealt with, and he could tell the world that he'd secured disarmament. And he wasn't allowed to go on. It wasn't France and Germany that stopped it. It was Britain and the US and Spain who said, no, we've run out of time. We want to pass a resolution saying 1441 hasn't been completed, and that gives the US and the UK the authority to go to war. And it wasn't just France and Germany. It was an overwhelming majority of the members of the Security Council, permanent members and rotating members, who said, no, we want Blix to complete his work. And President Chirac had made it clear before that he would vote against any immediate resolution that said Blix had failed, but that if Blix came back to the Security Council in a month or so and said he couldn't achieve disarmament, then the Security Council would have had to vote for war. So the question I keep asking is, why did we rush to war and divide the world when we could have given Blix a bit more time and kept the international community united in dealing with the problem of Iraq?
All right, Juan, thanks for your call. We're going to skip up to Wellesley, Massachusetts now. Ren's on the line. Hi, Ren.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Good morning, Ms. Short. Quick question. This is, to a lot of us, seems to have been a decision made long ago. Dan Shore and others, and as an earlier caller, had acknowledged. And I'm wondering, given that sort of a parameter and some of the now dubious nature of the information that had been used, PhD papers, et cetera, I'm wondering if the Brits were given all of the information that we had. Was it necessary for us to have another substantial partner in this?
You're suggesting, Ren, maybe there was even more information that Washington was holding that it wasn't sharing with Blair.
I'm wondering because there seems to be a lot of dubious information. The president is now saying, look, Iraq is free and Saddam is gone. What's the problem? Seems to be the attitude of now this information. Was the Blair government brought along, or were they fully partners? I'm wondering if Ms. Short has an opinion there.
Yes, and people here have asked that question, because people don't want to believe that their prime minister did mislead the nation. So the question was Tony Blair misled by President Bush? I don't believe so. I believe that the intelligence that was available to the UK was the same as the intelligence that was available to the US, that our intelligence services were cooperating and were sharing information. And I think that Tony Blair knew what he was deciding and sort of openly gave his commitment. There's a legal complication, because our Attorney General, our senior law officer, has to give a legal opinion saying that military action is legal or our armed forces would not obey an order even from the Prime Minister to engage in war. And the legal opinion was that the authority for war flowed from previous United Nations Security Council resolutions or committed to disarmament and finding the weapons of mass destruction. And it was legal to seek to overthrow the regime only because that was necessary to deal with the weapons of mass destruction. So if it had been openly argued that the aim of the war was to get rid of an evil regime, Britain couldn't legally have supported it.
I wonder if I can ask you, Claire Short, to take me on something of a personal journey here, and if we could start back, say, on the it would be the 20th of September 2001, when British Prime Minister Tony Blair was, for all intents and purposes, that honored guest at a special joint session of Congress right after the 9/11 attacks. I don't know if you remember it. I remember being quite moved when George Bush looked up at the gallery and said, "Once again, we're joined together in a great cause, so honored the British Prime Minister has crossed an ocean to show his unity of purpose with America. Thank you for coming, friend." And at a news conference during that very same visit, Mr. Blair said, and I'm quoting him here, "My father's generation went through the experience of the Second World War when Britain was under attack during the days of the Blitz, and there was one nation and one people that above all stood side by side with us at that time, and that nation was America, and those people were the American people. And I say to you, we stand side by side with you now without hesitation." And I think of the chemistry that those two men projected onto the nations at that time, and I look at this mess of what we're calling, you know, half-truths and deceptions that is being talked about in Britain, the questions that are now being raised in Washington. I want you to give me your view of how that relationship from just 2 years ago described by those two leaders may now be at risk.
Well, of course, I mean, the U.S. coming to the aid of Britain in the fight against Hitler was clearly big, historic, and an absolutely just cause. And Hitler was building concentration camps and gassing Jewish people and trade unionists and gay people in the way we all know. So to draw parallels with something as profound and massive as that is quite something. And certainly our Prime Minister, in a speech in Cardiff at the Welsh Labour Party conference, made those references to sort of Chamberlain and appeasement and trying to suggest that he was in a kind of historical parallel. And I think they demean that parallel, that this wasn't the same honourable cause. I mean, of course, September the 11th was a massive event, but the whole world felt for America. The whole world wanted to support America. The United Nations started action to require every single country in the world to take action to deal with terrorism and money laundering and the way in which such groups got support. So it wasn't just Britain that felt for America at that time. There was a genuine, fantastic feeling of support and sympathy and anxiety to help and not allow such events to take place again. And I think that was then misused, the historical parallel of our closeness, to pretend only our two countries were close and to throw away that fantastic unity of purpose that there was in the world to be close to the United States and support the United States after the terrible events of September 11th. So I think they were slightly milking history wrongfully.
Let's go then to where we are today, because if Prime Minister Blair is wounded for his alliance with Washington, then the end result of that is precisely what you're saying ought not to happen, and that would be a further isolation of the United States, with other European leaders or other world leaders saying, "Look what happened to Blair."
Yes, and that would be very bad. I mean, there was a mood in Europe in the run-up to the war that was hostile to the US, and people thinking, "We're a different people. We don't understand this belligerent nation," because, you know, people in Europe want to avoid war, very much believe in the United Nations, and we've got other differences, the Kyoto Protocol about global warming, the International Criminal Court, that we are all rather enthusiastic about the idea of an international rule of law that will deal with tyrants and war crimes. So there are all these differences between us. I think it would be a disaster for the world if we had polarization between Europe and America, or between the rest of the world and America. And there is a mood out there that's very hostile, and we mustn't let that happen. I mean, you are the biggest power in the world. We must all stay close together. There are a lot of dangers for the future in terms of poverty in the world and environmental degradation and failed states and the problem of hatred and terrorism and the unresolved problems in the Middle East. If Europe and America became polarized, we'd be paralyzed in what we could do. That would be a disaster. We mustn't let that happen.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. But, Claire, you also know that Britain's peculiar geographical location between America and Europe translates in politics as well, that prime ministers have certainly over the last 50 years and before that time functioned as translators, as links between America and Europe. And I'm trying to focus in on the likelihood or the possibility that Britain won't play that role in the future if Mr. Blair or his party or the nation is seen to have been somewhat blindsided in the explanations and the excuses and the reasons given for this war in Iraq.
I know you are, and I agree with you that that's a danger. Because, of course, the other big argument we're having in Britain is about our relationship with the European Union and the new euro, the currency for Europe that we're not a member of, mm-hmm. and the new constitutional arrangements for Europe when we're widening and taking in the Czech Republic and Poland and some of the former communist countries and countries of the Balkans, which is a wonderful thing that those countries can become part of democratic Europe and that the Balkans can get rid of the poison of ethnic hatred that has been so damaging in their history. So the other great passionate debate in Britain is how far we're fully part of Europe. And our danger is that we get stranded between the two relationships and then we're just a little island left on our own and we suffer. We're less useful in the world because we don't have influence with anyone and we suffer economic consequences. But I don't think it's an option for Britain to lose either relationship. I think we need to stay with the rest of Europe and keep our relationship with the US, but be a bridge genuinely rather than, I mean, some cartoonists here have had the image of Britain's the bridge, the link with the US, being a plank that we fell off the end of, and instead of being a bridge, we lost our connection with Europe, fell in with the US, became a fig leaf for an unwise conflict, damaged ourselves, and weren't really a good friend of the US because we just helped you to be isolated rather than to work with the rest of the world. So this isn't simple, but I'm absolutely clear we must avoid falling out and just saying the UK won't work with the US anymore and we'll just go in with Europe. Because if the world divides between Europe and America, it'll be bad for all of us.
Ms. Short, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Claire Short, former British Secretary of State for International Development, Member of Parliament from Birmingham, Ladywood. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.